You're listening to Clinical Conversations. I'm Joe Elia for the NEJM Group. The BMJ has just published an extensive meta-analysis on whether dietary levels of saturated fat and trans fat correlate with cardiovascular risk. The first author of that study is our guest. Dr. Russell D'Souza is an assistant professor in the Department of Clinical Epidemiology and Biostatistics at McMaster University in Hamilton, Ontario. Welcome to Clinical Conversations, Dr. D'Souza.
Thank you, Joe. I appreciate the opportunity to speak with you.
Well, before we start, let's take a look at the lineup of the suspects here. The saturated fats, as I believe, are found mostly in butter, meat, milk, and egg yolks, whereas the trans fats are industrially produced for the most part and are found in deep-fried foods and goodies like pies and cakes and donuts, which I can never get enough of. But is that generally accurate?
Yeah, it's generally accurate, and it's a bit of a historical question as well. So you're right with saturated fats. They're generally found in things like butter and meat products and eggs and cheese. Trans fats really come from two places. One is those produced by the food industry in the form of something called partially hydrogenated vegetable oil. It's a big, long name. Mm-hmm. But basically what those are they are liquid fat, so like an olive oil or a canola oil, that undergoes a chemical transformation to become a solid block of fat. So it's a process by which you take a liquid vegetable oil and turn it into a solid, so it looks like butter. And this, for many years, was found in baked goods and pastries, as you've said. But with recent legislation in both the U.S. And Canada, for example, and major voluntary efforts by the food industry, a lot of those trans fats are getting out of the food supply. Hmm. So the message is, if you see a food label that contains the words partially hydrogenated oil, that's where you're getting your trans fats from.
So give us, if you will, a kind of an elevator summary of your work in the BMJ and what you set out to do and what you found.
Yeah, sure. So what we set out to do was review the observational evidence for the association of trans and saturated fats with mortality or death, cardiovascular diseases, and diabetes. And what we found was that overall, saturated fats were not associated with any of these outcomes, but trans fats as an entire group were associated with the risk of death and coronary heart disease. We couldn't confirm associations between trans fats and diabetes and stroke because the studies were done in very different ways, which makes it difficult to draw firm conclusions. But overall, our study supports the recommendation to reduce trans fats. But our finding for saturated fats were inconclusive. Mm-hmm. We didn't find consistent or convincing evidence that they reduced or increased risk of any of the outcomes. But we couldn't rule out that higher saturated fat did increase the risk of dying from heart disease.
This meta-analysis, and it varied depending on the number of studies that you looked at, varied depending on which outcome you were examining. It seemed, as I was doing a sort of a rough estimate of how many people could have been involved altogether, it was close to 500,000 possible subjects were involved in the studies that you analyzed.
Yeah, that's about right. It's tough to estimate because there is some double counting with respect to the same studies reporting outcomes for both saturated and trans fat. Mm-hmm. So the exact number is an estimate.
Okay. And so just to review then the bidding. So with saturated fats, there was no strong association with all-cause mortality or cardiovascular mortality or total coronary disease. But you couldn't, but as you said, the confidence intervals were such that you couldn't rule out possibility that they could be. But the the trend seems to be, okay, these are fairly, relatively safer than trans fat, which you noted had a bit stronger association with all-cause death and coronary mortality and total coronary disease, but not stroke or diabetes.
Right.
Okay. There was a trans fat that you just sort of mentioned in passing that seems seems protective against type 2 diabetes, but there hasn't there aren't enough studies on it yet. And but it said to me that these studies are, I mean, we're talking about, you know, major nutrients. It's very difficult to discern what the effects are, because sometimes, as you also note in the paper, if you're going to substitute, say, saturated fat for trans fat, or if you're going to substitute carbohydrate, for instance, that in itself can have adverse outcomes.
Yeah, that's correct. And I think that's one of the main messages we hope came through in our paper, is that it's difficult to specify how harmful or helpful a macronutrient is without considering what you're comparing it to. So probably the best example of this has been the fat message that occurred throughout the 80s, and that the low-fat message was in vogue, and everyone said, you know, we need to get fat out of the food supply, and the food industry did that. And what happened is that we took the fat out and we put in things like refined carbohydrates and flours. So in our study, when we talk about higher levels of saturated fat, the people in the studies generally were eating less of this refined or highly processed carbohydrates. So when we look at that compared with refined carbohydrates, maybe it's true that saturated fats aren't that bad. However, we do see that in that same comparison, trans fats turn out to still be bad. And we did see evidence, not directly analyzed by us, but seen from other studies that we reviewed but didn't meta-analyze, that replacing either trans or saturated fat with polyunsaturated fat appears to be the best choice for cardiovascular disease risk reduction.
You also mentioned in dietary recall, which is where most of the data from the studies that you meta-analyzed came from, you say it's hard to distinguish between so-called industrially produced trans fat and the naturally occurring ones.
That's correct. So trans fat is difficult to measure by recall. And part of the reason that is that the food supply changed so much over the years that people's actual intake of trans fat may have changed very drastically without people changing what they ate. If we take the example of Oreo cookies, we might have a person who ate 10 Oreo cookies a day on a Friday, and then over the weekend, the trans fats were removed from those Oreo cookies, and they ate the same amount on Monday, but their trans fat intake had decreased substantially without them even trying. So there is that issue of difficulty capturing trans fat intake. We also have the issue of the databases in which some of these food frequency questionnaires or recalls were analyzed with. So care has to be taken to make updates to these databases so that they have accurate measures of how much trans fats is or is not in the food supply at a given time. So distinguishing individual sources of trans fatty acids can be challenging in epidemiologic studies. So really the best evidence we had was really for overall trans fatty acid from all sources.
So how would you explain the findings or those associations without going into biochemistry? I mean, you're a registered dietitian, and so your patients and colleagues would ask, so how does this stuff work, Dr. D'Souza? I mean, why can't I have some of the old-time, you know, donuts?
So trans fats specifically raise the bad cholesterol levels in the blood and lower the good cholesterol levels. So it gives you an unfavorable sort of total cholesterol to HDL ratio, which has been shown to predict future cardiovascular events. And also, trans fats may raise levels of inflammation in the blood and be particularly harmful to the cells that line the arteries. So it sort of produces, we believe, this general inflammatory state and doesn't do great things to the lipids in the blood.
Okay.
On the other hand, saturated fats raise both the LDL, or the bad cholesterol, as well as the good cholesterol. So it's possible from a lipid standpoint that saturated fats may be neutral.
Mm-hmm.
However, I think it's important to note that across the range of studies that we looked at, some of the highest containing saturated fat groups were consuming maybe 15 to 20% of saturated fat, and the lowest groups rarely consumed less than 9% of energy from saturated fat. So mm-hmm. we can only speak about effects throughout this range. We don't know if very low saturated fat diets in an observational setting or very high saturated fat diets in an observational setting have very different effects than what we saw.
Yeah. So what should your clinician colleagues change as a result of this research? What might they advise their patients next week that they weren't advising this week as a result of your work?
Yeah. So so I think the take home message from this study is that there's no one nutrient or food that's responsible for all heart disease or diabetes or death, and I think the focus needs now to shift on the whole diet.
Mm-hmm.
So we know that dietary patterns that emphasize plant foods, unsaturated fats like Mediterranean diets, mm-hmm. plant-based diets, or the DASH diet, they tend to be low in saturated fat, but we don't really know if their healthfulness is solely due to that fact, mm-hmm. their low saturated fat, or it's because they emphasize other healthful foods like fruits, vegetables, whole grains, nuts. And they generally tend to steer away from things like refined or processed carbs and industrial trans fats. So the message I would take away is certainly not a green light to eat as much saturated fat as you want,
okay.
But something to consider. Saturated fat is part of the whole diet, and really look at your entire diet and lifestyle approach. Are you maintaining a healthy weight? Are you exercising regularly? And are you getting enough fruits and vegetables and not smoking? So I think if we go away saying that the whole picture is important and that we really need to start thinking about the whole diet and lifestyle approach, that would be a good message to take away.
And for students of dietary epidemiology, are there lessons from your... I know that you're interested in the science of meta-analysis and making meta-analyses more accurate. Sometimes they're criticized for being just not as accurate as working with test tubes. But are there lessons for students of epidemiology that they can draw from this work?
Yeah, it's funny you mention that. And this morning when I was thinking about this process, I think meta-analyses are a very useful tool for synthesizing large amounts of information, but they really need to be done with care. And one of the things that we hope we were careful enough to do is combine like studies with like studies.
Mm-hmm.
And that meant that there were some studies that we came across that we felt we shouldn't pool in a meta-analysis, because doing so would lead to a false representation of what that individual study found. I'll give you one example.
Mm-hmm.
There's a very large study called the Pooling Project of Diet and Disease, and this was a study that actually looked at the individual patient data from a number of the large cohorts, many of which we reviewed in our analyses, but they were able to look directly at substitution effect. So if you replace saturated fat with polyunsaturated or monounsaturated fat, what were these effects? And we didn't want to include the results from this study in our overall meta-analysis, because the pooling project really gave you the best estimate of the effects. So what we felt we would do in the whole context of a systematic review of the literature was meta-analyze what we thought were reasonably combinable estimates. So we looked at prospective cohort studies together, case control studies together, and kept them separate. And then we also took some of these bigger studies, like the pooling project, and commented on them separately to see if they complemented or provided any new information to what we felt was safe to meta-analyze. So I think the important take-home message before embarking on a meta-analysis is to ask yourself, does it make sense to combine these estimates? Hmm. And for randomized controlled trials, this may be an easier answer. But for observational epidemiology, given the differences in base study populations, the heterogeneity or difference between analytic strategies, and length of follow-up and ways of measuring diet, it's really something that you have to undertake with care, and we hope that we did that well enough.
Well, the comment on it, especially the comment in Physicians First Watch, was that it was carefully done, and
thank you.
Harlan Krumholtz was the person that we quoted on that, so that's high praise coming from him. And so, what work is on the horizon now? Are you this looks like it was a rather intense undertaking, and so are you cranking up for other analyses?
Well, I think I'm going to sleep for 2 days first before we think about what else we do. I hope what this has done is provided perhaps more questions than it has answers.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the mark of good science. I think one of the most important questions to resolve going forward is this effect of what we call ruminant or natural trans fat compared with industrial trans fats. So for many years, we've had these industrial trans fats in the food supply, and they've really been the predominant source of trans fats that mm-hmm. we get in our diet. But now that the U.S. and Canada and many other countries are trying to get these out of the food supply, we'll be able to better assess the effect of the small amounts that remain.
Mm-hmm.
There are many groups now that are working on that as well, and we'd certainly like to propose future studies to be able to answer that question. I think another interesting area that we'd like to get into is sort of drilling down a little bit on saturated fat. You know, we've been able to look at it in this observational context, but, you know, is saturated fat in the context of an overall healthy diet and lifestyle still, you know, harmful as has been believed for many years? And I think looking at the whole diet approach will become very important. Saturated fat is one component, it's one nutrient, but it's not the whole diet. So I think future studies aimed at dietary patterns, which has been the direction that the Dietary Guidelines for Americans has gone, is certainly a step in the right direction. So moving away from this single nutrient focus toward the whole diet and lifestyle approach is certainly a good direction for future nutrition research.
Well, when you do that, Dr. D'Souza, I hope we'll be talking again. And
I would love to talk to you again, Joe.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for spending time with us today.
No problem. Thank you very much for this chance.
That was our 182nd clinical conversation. The previous conversations may all be found at podcasts.jwatch.org. Kristen Kelly is the executive producer. I'm Joe Elia. On behalf of the NEJM Group, thank you for listening. We'll see you next time.